Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today we welcome back Kelly Lannon. Kelly has experience in commercial real estate, but today he is here to talk to us about real estate through the Bitcoin lens. Kelly is here to present Bitcoin Urbanism. Kelly, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Nick. Thank you for having me.
Kelly has a vision for Bitcoin and how it can really change the entire way we think about building. So Kelly, I'll turn it over to you. What is Bitcoin urbanism? Why does it matter?
So Bitcoin urbanism is the exploration of returning to better aesthetics, higher quality craftsmanship, and long-term planning in what we call the built environment. It's important because there's many of us, including myself, who feel that the world that we inhabit physically, walking around and looking at, is not what it could be, especially when compared to, American or European cities at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century.
Okay, so
how did we get here, and how do we get back to where they were?
Okay, so Kelly has produced a fantastic slide deck for us to go through some history of real estate and building. So Kelly, let's start with the built environment.
So the built environment, I have a couple of little photos. One is of New York City in the early 20th century, and the other is a truck stop, I believe, in Missouri, which everybody kind of sees all over Twitter. It's one of the memes that won't go away. So the idea is, you know, we had a vibrant, dense cityscape, and now we live in a suburban landscape where everything's spread apart. You were required to have cars to get everywhere to do anything, really, and we're kind of plastered with corporate drive-throughs and gas stations and all these things that enter, freeway interchanges. So the idea is, you know, what are the development patterns that existed back in the day that we don't seem to follow now? And what is this, what's called the suburban experiment that we find ourselves in? So we went from a period of high quality construction, things that lasted a long time, planning that incorporated in a lot of different means of transportation and building uses, to something that we have today, which is basically use it once and essentially throw it away. So that leads us into the two different kinds of development patterns that we find ourselves in. So the first one is called the traditional development pattern. What that is a time-tested and iterative process where people build towns using essentially very low risk. So think about, the photos your grandparents showed you of a small town that had, you know, a shack with a door and a window, right? That was the beginning of any city or town that you find yourself in today. So people took low risks and got low rewards, but over time they were able to accumulate capital and expand their city. And the way that they did that was the easiest way possible, which is copying what everybody else did. So what you see essentially, especially across America, is the Main Street kind of development vibe, right? You have buildings that are smaller, closer together, one or two or three stories. Very often they're mixed use. There's little to no, you know, explicit parking. And the question is, how did we get away from something like this if this was so productive in the first place? A lot of times in these cities and towns, at least when they were built, there wasn't any development review boards, architecture boards, zoning ordinances preventing buildings being placed in certain places, setbacks and such like that. So this development pattern is very much evolutionary in nature and is essentially taking small bets to make improvements essentially in the plan layout and design. So next we have what it has changed to, which is called the suburban experiment. Now this is a term coined by Charles Morone of Strong Towns. People who are familiar with Strong Towns will notice that a lot of this stuff that I talk about is heavily influenced by Chuck's work. So if you're interested, I strongly recommend reading his book, Strong Towns, as well as the hundreds and hundreds of blog posts on his website. I found this stuff almost 15 years ago, and my life has been changed ever since. So what is the suburban experiment? This is essentially a top-down planning methodology of land use. This is epitomized by the single-family subdivision on the outskirts of town. So what happens is that using Detroit's quote-unquote success during the 20s and 30s, the U.S. government decided that that was a good way to employ a lot of World War II vets, as well as giving them all favorable mortgages with the GI Bill. So Detroit didn't get hit as hard as everybody else during the Great Depression. One of the reasons they thought that was because they had a different real estate development model. So the suburban experiment requires a lot of labor and a lot of capital. So by keeping everybody busy and providing funding to keep everybody busy, it was essentially thought that it was a good idea to use as a platform proceeding. So a lot of what we think about today regarding the suburban experiment can also be considered the American dream, owning a house with some land, kids, dogs, white picket fence, nice neighbors, all that stuff. So that's where a lot of this comes from.
The Bitcoin Layer is sponsored by River. River is a Bitcoin-only exchange if you guys are looking for a place to get allocated. Go check them out today at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 in Bitcoin for free when you purchase. The most important thing about River is that River does not use a third-party custodian for Bitcoin. That means when you purchase Bitcoin on River, River has its own storage solution and is not relying on any third party to custody that Bitcoin. It also means that they have an amazing technical expertise. It's a great team over there at River. Go check them out, river.com/TBL. Kelly, I want to just bring in the banks real quick, because banks issuing these mortgages, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are such a staple, an enormous part of our financial system. And even just to think about the fixed income market at large, the presence of mortgage-backed securities and the presence of those securities being due to the existence of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the backing of those mortgages throughout the system. And so I think even go even one step further in terms of this whole central planning and providing mortgages for soldiers after World War II with the GI Bill, add in the banks and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and maybe just think about the suburban experiment from an even larger perspective when it comes to how our entire financial system operates.
Correct. So it would not be a stretch to say that almost the entire American financial system depends on the single family subdivision, and that its creation, existence, continuance, and expansion is really what underpins a lot of financial activity. So we'll definitely get there. So let's think about it this way. In order to have the suburban experiment, you need a car. And as the birthplace of mass manufacturing for vehicles, Detroit literally became the example to use. So all subdivisions and development going forward should have and use the car. What we have today is essentially, almost 100 years of that. So keep in mind with the single family subdivision that in order to get to that, you have to have cars. And the more that you have, the more cars you need, the more infrastructure you need. So what does the suburban experiment do? So next we have two different aerials. Of Cincinnati, Ohio. One is before, is 1955, which is the year before the Federal Aid Highway Act. And the other is in 2016. So this is essentially a 60-year snapshot of what the various interventions of, legal and financial interventions that have occurred in that time. So you took a once dense, vibrant city, and you've essentially gutted it for transportation and parking. Now, this is all to meet the needs of essentially suburbia and cars. So this is a good example, which we'll kind of show later, of the tremendous destruction of wealth that occurred throughout cities across the U.S. So as for the interventions themselves, I've listed what I think are the six most important. First is the creation of the Federal Reserve, which allows them to set the price of money. Next is what's the probably the most notable Supreme Court case related to this, which is Euclid versus Ambler, which started over a, I guess the village of Euclid wanted Ambler Realty to set back their hotel. I believe it was like 10 or 12 feet back from where they originally had it along the street. And they said, no, let's go talk to the Supreme Court about it. Supreme Court ruled that the village of Ambler had the jurisdiction over land use within their, essentially their borders. So this is the legal backing for why, you know, all cities have the right to control zoning and ordinances related to property, essentially today. Next, we have the National Housing Act, which is a New Deal legislation that created the FHA. The FHA is essentially what federally insures mortgages. You had mentioned Fannie and Freddie earlier. Fannie and Freddie, for those who don't know, either package mortgages into MBS or hold mortgages themselves. So Fannie is kind of responsible for, if you will, the secondary market for buying and holding these mortgages long term so that the banks don't have to sit on them. Next, we have the Federal Aid Highway Act. I had mentioned that earlier. What this did was it created the funds to make and build the highways, but local jurisdictions got to pick where they went. So if you can imagine how local politics works in a situation like this, where they get to choose which neighborhoods to raise to build a highway, you can kind of imagine the things that happened. Lots of essentially poor and racial neighborhoods, you know, got bulldozed in order for new highways to come in. So you can't kick half the people out of town and expect to, you know, continue to operate the same way. So that was quite devastating. The next up we have is what I have is the Nixon shock. That's taking the dollar off the gold standard. And that kind of allows credit-based money to run free as long as they don't drop the ball. So in my opinion, that's kind of the beginning of the transition away from gold as a store of value to real estate as a store of value. So since 1971, the monetary premium has accrued more to real estate than anything else. And then next we have TARP. This is probably the most explicit version of the government buying quote-unquote bad loans. And it's continued ever since. So it trends upwards. It comes down every once in a while. I think it was up to 2.75 trillion at the highest, and now it's down to about 2.4. But, you know, as of 20 years ago, it was near zero. So there's something to think about there. So with all of those changes at a federal level, what happened to the people organizing and doing things in the market? Well, so we've mentioned Detroit a couple times. They were the first one to kind of pioneer how to build a suburb, how to have a commuter town. And essentially, like I mentioned earlier about the traditional development model, people just copy what they see. So coming back to post-World War II, the government said, well, Detroit didn't do so bad during the Great Depression. Maybe it's this model of living that they have. Let's do it everywhere. So that kind of top-down decision-making got incorporated into the GI Bill, which provided subsidies for returning vets specifically for this purpose. So the biggest, I guess the biggest market winners would be Leavitt and Sons, who were essentially the first to mass produce homes and the typical home builder sense that we have today. So they incentivize subcontracting. It was very typical of a builder at the time to be able to do all the trades all at once. So they would bring their crew and they would start from, you know, the beginning working on the foundation all the way through the end to, you know, installing light bulbs and appliances. So what we have is much different today, where each trade is essentially its own company And this dates back to Leavitt and Sons. So in order to meet the demand, they essentially sacrificed aesthetic qualities, ornamentation. They made everything very simple, and they were handsomely rewarded in the process. Leavitt, I think by the time that he sold his company, he had built over 140,000 homes. So that's a lot. For people keeping track at home on an annual basis today, that's almost, I think it's 12% of the homes built every year. So, 80 years ago, that would have been quite a feat. So moving forward, the results, how did this work out over time? So on the next few slides, this is all information from a firm called Urban 3. They process data from city historical records related to tax. So this is what's called a value per acre analysis. It takes into account essentially how taxes are levied, the quantity, and then they apply that. You know, if a small shop, a mom and pop shop in Main Street only takes up 4,000 square feet and an acre is 43,000 square feet, you know, they extrapolate the value of the land upwards. So we can start with the snapshot on the left, which is from 1900. So that's near when Eugene was founded. You can see kind of very small towards the center right that was the downtown original area. That was the original town. And as we move further to the right through time, town expands. But the biggest thing to notice is that the jump between 1936 and 1970. During that 24 year span of time, 34 year span of time, that's where Euclid versus Ambler takes over. That's where the federal housing subsidies take over, insured mortgages, all of these other things, so that credit is given to real estate as a favored industry in order to expand. So you have an explosion of the area of specific towns outward. So now as we look at the chart, the purple areas are essentially the highest valued areas per acre. If this is like a typical Urban 3 chart, the purplish lines are going to be upwards of $1 million per acre, whereas the darkest green lines are between zero and $50,000 per acre. So you have a very concentrated area where value is accruing. Now, when we move to 2017, we can basically see that the entire jurisdictional area of Eugene has been developed in some sense, whether that's a farm on the outside of town or a tower in downtown. So how does this affect Eugene itself, right? So we move to the next series of images. On the left, we have in gold all of the areas that are zoned for single family homes. So for people who aren't familiar with zoning, is that it is a legal restriction on the uses of a certain parcel, right? Now, when cities draw the stuff, they usually just draw a big square. They don't do it parcel by parcel. So next to that is what we have is the revenue and expense ratio of each of those parcels. Okay. So when you're looking at these images, it's all the same parcels all the time. So the things in gray to black that are above the plane, so to speak, are net positives, whereas everything else in red is net negatives. So there's varying degrees of those. Now, if you notice, you're starting to see a pattern, is that the further away that you get, the less return you are getting for essentially the infrastructure that you have out there, because all of these places have to have streets, roads, sewer, water, all the services that are required. So there's a very small area of town that is producing the revenue needed in order to subsidize everything else. The next slide is the, if you will, the horror movie version of how much drain the red areas from the previous picture are on the city. So you have a lot more you have a lot more net negative parcels draining the city than you do net positive parcels filling the coffers. And you can kind of guess by the thickness of the net negative that the city of Eugene, Oregon probably is having a rough time paying its bills. So when we look at it like this, it's all good and dandy, but how do we think about the actual infrastructure that is servicing these people? So in order to do that, there's a lot of pipe that has to be laid, so to speak. So next are two examples of two different cities. One is South Bend and the other is Kansas City. They both have snapshots from different times. The difference is that one had a decrease in population, the other had an increase. So in South Bend, the population between 1960 and 2020 went down by, 22%. But the quantity of lift stations, which is to move essentially sewage, exploded by 1,300%, right? And not only that, but the quantity of forced main miles per person at 0.3 exploded to 19. So the burden of that infrastructure went up significantly, but the quantity of people that have to bear that burden went down by 22%. So this doesn't just apply to places where people leave, right? So when we look at Kansas City, the population of Kansas City almost doubled between 1910 and 2020. The problem is that the quantity of lineal feet of sewer per person went up by 27 times that growth. So you have a situation where even though there's more people, there's still even more infrastructure required to service all of those people. Now this kind of gets into, okay, well, if you build it, you have to maintain it. And if you maintain it after a while, you have to replace it because, you know, when you use things, they have to be replaced. That's just, you know, how the laws of essentially thermodynamics work. So how does that work? So we want to talk about the infrastructure life cycle and replacement of basically anything. You can apply this to anything. In this case, it's a road. Again, this is from Urban 3. Fantastic data, fantastic information. So people are wondering, it's like, well, Kelly, why is there zero cost for the road at the beginning? And that's because the developer who typically builds a subdivision is responsible for paying for or building the road that services the subdivision that they're building. Okay, so I'm responsible. I build the road to my subdivision. And then when I near the end, the city reviews everything and then they accept it as a gift. So the city is given. They don't have to pay for the road or anything. In fact, I have to pay them fees in order to have the right to build the road. So over time, they're responsible for maintaining it, doing different things. But after a while, in this case, the life cycle of a road is about 50 years. They have to replace it. So where do they get the money from to do that? Typically, it's in property taxes. Sometimes they have it in a general fund, although that's definitely not advised because politicians and general funds don't go well together. So if we have to rebuild it, where are we getting the money from and how does the cash flow work? Next, we want to talk about what Chuck Morones has coined is called the growth Ponzi. This is where things start to kind of come together. With the suburban experiment, we have to have car-centric design. We have to have car-centric infrastructure. We have to have infrastructure that can reach those subdivisions. And then even if the city has gifted them, they have to be maintained and taken care of. So essentially, how does the cash flow for that work? Well, it doesn't. The cities collect a certain amount over time in taxes, and then at the end of the infrastructure's life cycle, in this case, the graph from Strongtown shows 25 years. The city has to go out and replace this. Now, this doesn't account for inflation over time or necessarily collecting the right amount of taxes. It's collecting the taxes that you can collect before essentially the citizens get upset about it. So you're kind of hamstrung as a city being able to collect the taxes that you need to collect because they're not required to essentially outlay as a mandatory, capital reserve, if you will, in order to pay for these things because ordinances can change. The city can vote to do things differently with their money. So there's no way in order to prevent this. So what you have is what's called the growth Ponzi. This is where in order to take care of old infrastructure, I have to build new subdivisions and collect fees and then use those fees to take care of previous subdivisions. So if it sounds like a Ponzi, that's because it is. The issue is that like all Ponzi's, it can't go on forever because it requires more money, more growth, and more infrastructure in order to continue to exist. But eventually you just run out of space, right? So approximately after the third cycle, which is about 75 years, the entire cash flow falls apart. There's a good example of the city of Chicago, where they had to publish, I think it was 2022, that they have an annual budget of about $38 billion, and that their infrastructure had gotten so bad that they needed to realize some of the repairs. But in order to do that, they had to realize $21 billion of repairs to all of their infrastructure. So that was almost two thirds of the entire budget for the city of Chicago for 1 year. So to think that the city is essentially able to manage these things anymore is kind of a pipe dream to stay on the topic, so to speak. So if they're not able to pay for it, who pays for it? That kind of moves into the federal side of things. So a lot of times when infrastructure is built in a city, a substantial to almost half of the money that a city receives is from federal government. And this could be as small as a sidewalk to a school, or this could be a water treatment plant. One of the water treatment plants in my city was substantially paid for by federal funds. So does the city collect enough money and hold it in a capital reserve to replace it in 50 years? Most likely not. The simplest probable thought would be that they can go back to the feds and request more money to replace what had already been built.
Kelly, when we think about the city's completely unable to maintain the infrastructure over a long enough time horizon, you're suggesting that it guarantees that federal support will have to plug the gap. And if we think about the unfunded liabilities of Medicare and Social Security, which politically should remain intact, I think, for many years to come, isn't this another unfunded liability for the federal government that we're not even coming close to calculating?
Absolutely. So I read it somewhere that the longer an empire or superpower essentially continues to exist, the less focus it has domestically, essentially on taking care of what it has. So my family has a ranch in northern Arizona. A very good example of this would be working with the Forest Service to just repair barbed wire fences, right? And that essentially there's no, as we don't own the land, right? We have a lease to use it. But as part of our lease, because the lease is so cheap, we're essentially responsible for taking care of it. Now, the federal government, through the Forest Service, provides materials to us in order to do that. But that's only as much material as they have. A good example would be 1 year when we had to replace something like 5 miles worth of barbed wire fence, and they had the equivalent of half a mile worth of material. And there just wasn't anything else to requisition because, you know, we're not the only rancher. There's dozens of other ranchers around us in the area, and that's just what they had left. So if you take that as a microcosm of all the bridges, roads, highways, et cetera, that exist in the U.S., it becomes quite a bleak picture of, you know, not only are we responsible for a lot of these social promises that we've made, but we have hard physical things that have to be taken care of. It's almost a meme at this point that the Civil Engineers Society of the U.S. puts out a report every year and grades, you know, U.S. infrastructure as a D or an F. And that's quite literally because, you know, if funds are allocated towards a bridge to go to a certain town, those funds may, you know, get diverted to another politically favorable industry or organization or sorts of other things. So infrastructure could be used to set up those funds, and then at the last minute they get swapped out for something else. So taking care of infrastructure is not sexy politically. And essentially when you have overbuilt it and you have no way to replace or maintain it, then yeah, you have quite a large problem. So yes, that's a good thought.
I think the figure might come from the Army Corps of Engineers, because I do remember seeing it quite often, and it's multi-trillions in terms of the gap. We've mentioned recently on the show about this actually came from Luke Grohman's appearance on Preston Pysh when he explained how the deficiency of simply electricity transmission puts us at a $3 trillion deficit just there. And I'm not even, I'm not even sure the Army of, you know, Army Corps of Engineers is thinking about the future build out of electricity needs. It's only thinking about the maintenance of, and I'll just add one more thing in. In the effort to financially repress, inflation must be somewhat of a mandate. And you talk about credit expansion funding a lot of this problem. The problem, as you outlined, is some or mostly due to the ease of credit access and then the government sponsorship and expansion of that access. Right. And then you overlay the Nixon shock, but just generally money going off of a hard standard. And now you have the real estate premium put on it because it is one of the best forms of property that we have had up until date to protect ourselves from the government. Basically, that's what we're protecting ourselves from, is the government plus central banks, but it's the government. Right. And so when we think about all of these things together, what we face from the real estate, the infrastructure replacement side, is it's almost a certainty that you will get those replacement projects issued by the feds. When bridges collapse, or when a ship runs into a bridge, and the bridge falls down, you need to have another bill, and you'll have some massive bill. It won't just be, here's $500 million to replace this. It's, oh yeah, by the way, we do need $3 trillion, so let's try to jam at least $1 trillion through the next time. Some of those funds will get diverted anyway and won't go towards the maintenance of the infrastructure. And so the Ponzi scheme you're describing at the city level, it really applies to the whole government and the entire financial system, because you can't have credit contraction because it destroys banks. So you must have credit expansion. In that credit expansion, the federal government will snap up some of it, and it only some of it will go toward the necessary infrastructure maintenance. And so you're at a permanent deficiency, and it, in a way, permanently leaves the dollar denomination itself subject to devaluation. Sorry for the.
No. I think you're 100% on track. So the transition from the traditional development pattern to the suburban experiment is essentially moving the requirement for infrastructure, I guess, as a capital expenditure and as a maintenance, from localities to the federal government, right? Because with a printing press, you're the only one as the federal government or the central bank who can, you know, technically afford to do it. Once you build these giant, the federal highway system is one of the largest human, if not the largest human construction project on the planet. So when you start to do things that you normally otherwise wouldn't be able to do without access to cheap credit or credit itself in general, then yeah, the risk moves up further, closer towards the central bank. And the important thing to also think about this, that Parker Lewis talks about all the time, is that in order to do this, you know, you have to manage your essentially dollars to debt ratio to make sure that you're not getting too far ahead of yourself. If you have to print a bunch of dollars in order just to, you know, make sure that people can drive to work, then you're probably in a pretty precarious situation, especially when a lot of the financial system is built on these subdivisions, home loans, and all of the things that go around it. So you've got a situation where you're essentially required to continuously print the dollar to maintain infrastructure that's now probably, 75 to 100 years old, that's never been replaced.
Okay, Kelly, so keep going with your presentation. For whom the infrastructure bill tolls?
Okay, so the basic concept to understand, and this is from my perspective as a developer, is that let's say I want to build homes. And now is a unique time because mortgage rates are very high. So if people can't afford the homes I build, then I don't build, right? And if you take it up an abstract layer further from that, if you're working at the mortgage company and you have a buyer that wants to come in and buy a home, they come to get pre-qualified. So, rates are high. So what do? You reach out to whoever runs the desk at your office and say, are we going to be able to sell this mortgage before we close it? That's typically how those mortgages work. So they're going to reach out to the secondary market, either primary dealers who are going to sell it to Fannie Freddie or who themselves are going to hold it for, a couple months before selling it. So at that layer, it's like, okay, well, if there's not a primary market for these things, is there even a secondary market? So if you are the guy who's going to buy the mortgage before it closes and you turn around and say, hey, Fannie Mae, are you going to buy this? And they're going to say, no, we don't, we can't buy it. It's like, okay, well, then who's going to buy it? Well, theoretically, now you could turn to the Fed. You have reached essentially, at that point, you've reached the highest level that you can possibly go in order to offload essentially these mortgages, which could turn into mortgage-backed securities. So the Fed currently owns about 30% of all U.S. Residential mortgage debt that exists today. So think about it this way. If the Fed had not owned so much, would there have been any residential development in the last 10 years? And my opinion and thoughts are is absolutely not. So we have reached a point now where the suburban experiment, which is what a lot of things rides on, is in so much trouble that the Federal Reserve is the one who is buying these mortgage-backed securities to get it off the books of other people so that it can filter down, right? So essentially their books can be refilled by offloading it to the Fed. Now, without the Fed there, I have such a hard time thinking that anything really even gets built. So today is a good example where most of the home sales that occur today are just new homes, right? So there's not a lot of people that are leaving or reselling their homes because they have golden handcuffs with, I've heard friends that have as low as like a 2.2% 30-year mortgage, which, when your home would retrade today for 7.5% on the mortgage, that's, why would you ever leave? And that's typically people's response. Why would I ever leave? Where am I going to go? So that's where we are. So if we think about that, we go, okay, well, if there's so much credit that's flowing to it and there's such a premium that has accrued to it and everything rides on it, and we're kind of starting to see the cracks because we've taken essentially the risk of the debt all the way to the highest level, then what is real estate's essential, relative value to everything else? So there's two pictures on this slide. One is from Jesse Myers, fantastic. And the other is from Leon Walkham. If you guys don't follow either of them, I highly recommend it. So Jesse's kind of, I don't even know what to call it, bar allocation is, in my opinion, quite apt to describe just how big this entire monetary premium has gotten on real estate. Now, let's look at real estate from like 100 years ago. It has a specific function and purpose, right? It's not used to store value or wealth over time. It's used to live in, to build something in, to conduct business in, or it's something that's used for the public. It's a park, courthouse, all of these other things. So its basic use wasn't as a way to save wealth through time. It was to actually provide a physical space for a physical purpose, right? So next to that, we have Leon's chart, which kind of shows the monetary supply and then the value of residential real estate and commercial real estate by comparison. So I'm not a statistician, but that looks like correlation to me, right? So the idea is that if there's more money in existence and real estate is much closer to the cancel on credit spigot than everything else, then it would track that real estate prices are probably going to track pretty closely with the quantity of money that's in the system, especially, you know, when we look backwards to some of the things that we've talked about, that the federal government subsidizes residential real estate in so many ways and so heavily that there's little reason to believe that, you know, barring another sort of financial crisis, that real estate prices wouldn't continue to track the quantity of money in existence. So this is where things kind of start to get interesting. Things have changed essentially in the last 15 years, whereas there is a new option for people to maintain wealth through time, and that has better qualities than real estate, and that would be Bitcoin. So how does Bitcoin, or excuse me, how does real estate compare to other assets that are trying to preserve your wealth through time? And with Bitcoin, I think that as we get now 15 years into it, the siphoning is kind of just starting to occur. So the idea is that if real estate is no longer the best place to store your value through time, and there's a better option, how many other people know about this option? So that's the distribution of knowledge that Parker likes to talk about, that as time passes, more knowledge distributes, but it doesn't distribute evenly. It comes and goes, it ebbs and flows. So one of the graph that I have here is based on Vijay Boyapati's bullish case for Bitcoin. Fantastic article if you guys haven't read it. But what I kind of did is I added real estate and I kind of inserted what I believe are the comparative values. Now, remember, this is just real estate as a store of value. This is the monetary premium that we've mentioned before. I'm not necessarily concerned about whether or not it cash flows or these other things, because that's not really a reason that you buy it. People will buy real estate in hopes that their equity appreciates. That's the growth in value that people are looking for. The cash flow basically just pays the bills. That handles the operational risk of the real estate itself. So if you have a situation where you went from one store of value that has operational risk and has equity growth risk, right, and the values go up or down, you know, why would I continue to own that if there's a better option for me to use that is maybe relatively new, but is superior when I'm looking at it through that specific lens? So, you know, that's kind of how I laid this out. I don't know if I necessarily need to go through all of them, but people can kind of see that, like, really, when you look at it, if you have to look at it, real estate really isn't that great. The only reason that it's been like that for the last 50 years is because there's really nothing else to do. Gold has long been neutered, and it hasn't been an effective store of value necessarily. And it's like, okay, well, on the gradient of hard assets to use, you know, between gold and real estate, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of space for people to consider other things. So at all time, people are trying to figure out, where am I going to save my value, right? Where can I save it through time to protect my purchasing power? And I think that we are getting closer to the stage where people are starting to understand maybe real estate isn't necessarily the best place to store value. And in conjunction with the other things that we've learned, we know that it's a heavily subsidized, industry, and that there's lots of things built on federal mandates and federal money that if those things changed or went away, you know, a lot of suburban neighborhoods might be totally worthless because the cost to maintain and replace all the infrastructure to get to those neighborhoods is way more expensive than all of the value that people could, or even all of the cash that people could put together to maintain it. This would be a good time to mention that, you know, if you live in a subdivision and have an HOA, right? A lot of times the HOA is responsible for maintaining all the infrastructure, the sidewalks, the streets, water, sewer lines within that legal subdivision, right? And that if something happens and it has to be replaced, the HOA is going to do a special assessment for every property. They say you're within, you know, our legal tract and you are partially responsible for all of this. Well, what happens when real estate prices come down 20% and you have no equity in your home? You can't borrow any money against your house in order to pay that bill. Even if it's $10,000 or $20,000, you know, using existing federal data about what people have in their bank account for emergencies, you know, that could be 20 to 40 to 50 times more money than they have. So in a situation like that, if you can't pay your bill, the HOA files a lien on your house to take it and then sell it so that they can get the money to pay for the sewer line. Now, that's just one thing and one person in one house. What happens if the whole neighborhood is like that? So these are things to consider, that when you are built on so much debt and things start to go wrong and there's no cash anywhere to take care of it, you have quite a problem on your hands. And I think that's when I think that what you said earlier about the federal government literally just printing money to take care of these things, I think that that will happen in our lifetime, and that there's no way around the math and around the physical reality that a lot of the stuff now is really old. And even the stuff that's not so old has to be fixed or replaced. So with all this money.
And nobody has the existing capital to replace it. So the cities don't have it. The states don't have it. The individuals don't have it. Yeah. And the feds don't have it, but they can create it quickly by borrow and spend. And then the Fed is there. And what you mentioned about, would we have even had any home construction over the last decade if it wasn't for the MBS portion of quantitative easing? It's an important thought experiment, because people sometimes think, I mean, you hear mainstream economists and commentators sometimes say something like, oh, QE doesn't distort the price of interest rates because it's an asset swap, or things like that. And while in isolation, it might be factual in some ways in the short term, especially when you think about QE in the early years when they were buying treasuries, rates went up because of the behavioral effect of stimulus making the future growth and inflation expectations go up. So rates went up instead of down, which QE is buying treasuries supposed to manipulate rates lower. So there's some truth in it. But when you really think about the churn of Fannie and Freddie, and if, like you said, if the broker knows he or she can't sell the loan right away, they won't issue it. They won't even issue it. And if they're not issuing it, no builder is building it, and on down it goes. So it is so important to think about the grand manipulation in real estate in the recent years, having nothing to do with all this suburban, car-driven, subdivide dynamic that we've been in for many decades. This whole new QE era, it's really important to think about that we might not have any home construction if the Fed wasn't involved in mortgage QE. So, yep. Kelly, I'll let you get back to now thinking about Bitcoin urbanism.
So we want to talk about now that there's all this money that is sloshed around all this time. There's a saying that time is money, but now I think time is less money. So in the built environment, you have to, there's no abstract creation process, right? Maybe other than creating the set of plans. Somebody has to take an idea, find people to physically do it, physically build it, right? This all takes time and effort. And the idea that if there is ever increasing quantities of money to make all this stuff happen, then, you know, you have more money chasing essentially the same quantity of goods, and things become less valued in that money. And when you have something like construction or real estate in general, that, you know, you still have to have people show up to do the job, the physical job. Somebody has to set the forms, pour the concrete, frame the house, plumb the house. You know, all of these takes people and materials. But if you are now in a situation where it becomes a financialized rat race, you have to do it as quickly as possible in order to essentially maintain your purchasing power, so to speak. So if your time is being devalued because they're printing more money, then you need to be able to do your job in less time. So you're trying to scale back your time in order to keep the same parity for purchasing power, right? So in real estate, and I've seen this just in the, oh my goodness, my 14 years of doing this full time, is that I can see it over time, going to a job site, watching somebody work, and the effort that they put into just the final details, right? So there's a saying in construction that the last 10% of the job requires, you know, 90% of your effort, and that it's all of the finished detail work, right? The small things that people overlook, or they forget a small piece of baseboard or a corner bead or all these other things that require somebody to drive back to the job and go back up the stairs and do something in 2 minutes that they should have done, you know, a month ago. So as their time is essentially devalued, the craftsmanship declines because there's no incentive to go the extra mile or to do things in a manner that I don't want to say necessarily that you would be proud of, but there's so much labor-saving technique today in construction that it really doesn't require craftsmanship anymore. Really, the only craftsmen are probably the framers, who are, you know, responsible for the essential construction of the backbone of the entire house, right? So we have a situation where, you know, a single family home is a churn and burn activity when they build it. You know, they fly. There's actually a handful of really good accounts on Twitter. If people want to look at people who do home inspections, they always post videos, right? There's a guy who takes his camera and he'll go up into the drywall and he'll look at the framing, and they'll notice that like entire rooms aren't actually nailed to any of the structural members in the house, right? Now, why is that? That comes back to, you know, what I'm trying to articulate with craftsmanship, is that as time gets devalued, so does the craftsmanship itself. Like, it's not that you don't want to do it, but you can't afford to do it. You can't afford to spend any more time in that house than you absolutely necessarily have to. So quality declines as a result. And when you get this kind of reduced value of labor and the churn and burn of a financialized asset, you know, you basically get high time preference choices across the whole board. So once you know that, you know, you need to simplify housing plans, designs, all of these other things, it flows back up to the implementation of the subdivision itself. So you essentially end up with stripped down versions of, you know, what could have been. And I included a quote by Michael Saylor that he had posted a couple of years ago, that the road to serfdom is working exponentially harder for a currency growing exponentially weaker. And having been around the trades quite literally my whole life, like I can see that. I've seen it. And it makes my job close to not being fun, because you're just arguing about people doing simple things that they need to do in order for me to have a product to sell. So that's kind of where this all ends up, is that now you have an entire system built up on debt. The suburban experiment is so ingrained into the financial system and its, you know, contingency and its dependence, that on the back end, what you're actually building is hardly even worth what somebody paid for it, because it's kind of just slapped together. So you've got a situation where something that's really important now is riding on something that's really bad, in my opinion. So, or a product that's really bad. So, you know, this kind of leads into the summation of what Bitcoin urbanism is. So how do we clean up the block, as I like to think. So as Bitcoin knowledge distributes as a store of value, that value will be siphoned away from real estate itself over to Bitcoin. How much of that is siphoned over? I, you know, I'm not quite sure. It's hard to say because there's so much that's writing on it that it can't go down too much. That harkens back to like a 2008 era saying, or even before that, where real estate, you know, prices don't go down because they can't go down. And that's very much true, but not for the reasons that people were saying at the time. They were just saying that because the American economy was built on housing, right? Not necessarily that it has to work because there's so much debt riding on it that it is, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a structural pillar that can't go away, especially for the financial system. So, you know, when we reduce real estate's monetary premium, a lot of other things start to happen. A lot of real estate development is dependent on local political processes. That means that other people are involved. That means that they have a say. So that's where you hear about NIMBYs and YIMBYs. NIMBY is not in my backyard, where a YIMBY is the opposite, where it says yes in my backyard. So these people are constantly fighting about everything. I've met all different flavors of these people at different meetings, and I've been called lots of different names for different reasons. And my thought is that as the necessity of people's dependence on real estate for wealth creation and wealth preservation basically goes away, that this idea of real estate being a local political issue where it affects everybody's, you know, values and wealth, so to speak, can also go away with it. And I can't tell you how many times we've been to places or tried to do things where, you know, politically it's just not possible. And I think that that is because of real estate's monetary premium being so high and so important to regular folks that own their homes, that if that went away, that the built environment would be a lot nicer. There'd be a lot more variety. And I guess just it'd be much more aesthetic, in my opinion. And what really matters is that when people have a way to securely, you know, save wealth into the future, that essentially that they can, and that it's not dependent on so many other things. Now, like, the average person doesn't know all this, right? But the idea is that, you know, the Bitcoin price is the Bitcoin price, but there's no, you know, the Federal Reserve isn't buying debt that is dependent on other activities, which leads into that, which would be the case for real estate. So at the end of the day, Bitcoin urbanism is essentially understanding the built environment that we're in and how we got here, essentially, you know, how the financial productivity of land use itself creates wealth as opposed to destroys it. The activities that we have with debt today and how it continually compounds on top of itself is destructive. The other thing that I kind of, you know, like to think about is the value premium or the monetary premium, how it siphons away and what prices could be. I don't think necessarily that, you know, it'll be down 50% because that's a lot. And not just because it's a lot, but because comparative to other things, you know, real estate has value in cash flows, right? It does operationally produce wealth. It's just that how much do you pay for that when, you know, you can go to a mutual fund and get 5.5%. So if I want to buy an apartment today and somebody wants to sell it to me for a cap rate of 5.5%, I take lots of operational risk in order to do that. So would I rather own a mutual fund and sleep soundly at night, or am I going to wake up in the middle of the night because a toilet's broken, right? Or there's a plumbing problem. That's what real estate investors compare to when they look at allocating their funds. And that kind of leads into, you know, interest rates and inflation rates, how that affects all the things in the built environment. And kind of like I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I think that a lot of the intrusions that we've seen is essentially what has led to the decline in beauty and craftsmanship and the low time preference choices that, you know, like Belle Epoque era cities and towns just exuded, or I would say massive drip, as the kids these days say. In line with that, there's a quote from, I read it somewhere, I can't remember, that if aliens ever arrived to to Earth in the early 20th century, they would think that Vienna was the capital of the world because of just how wonderful and beautiful it is. And if people haven't looked at photos of Vienna, I highly recommend you spend a half hour of your time today Google searching it. It's a beautiful place. And lastly, a lot of it is about being bottom up and not top down. So bottom up is, you know, you and your neighbors deciding to improve something, working with your town to improve things, to have better planning, to allow for different buildings and such like that. So the image that's included in the slide is was taken in 2022 in a town called Bisbee, Arizona, which is a mining town. And I'm standing in front of a famous hotel called the Copper Queen. And I happen to be walking out of it after lunch. And I look down and notice that the original brick street was underneath, you know, that inch of asphalt. And I thought that that was a very apt understanding for, you know, what Bitcoin urbanism is that these the bones and the understanding and the knowledge is there. We've just covered it up with an inch of asphalt. And that, you know, we can return, so to speak, but we can return in a way that is much better. And I think that when we apply Bitcoin to that equation, that that's how we can do it. And that's why I'm here.
Bitcoin urbanism is both understanding the built environment in which we live, but also finding the path to more beauty, craftsmanship, and a changing of our relationship with real estate, which has evolved in a way that Kelly described, very manipulated by governments and certain court decisions and the banking era that we live in. But in a Bitcoin world, it might look very differently. Kelly Lannon, thank you so much for your presentation today. We can find Kelly's work at bitcoinurbanism.substack.com, and we look forward to reading a lot more from you on this topic.
Well, thank you again for having me, Nick. It was a wonderful time.
Take care, guys. We'll catch you guys next time. The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by River. River is a Bitcoin-only exchange, and we think it is the best place for you guys to get allocated if you have made that decision to purchase Bitcoin. So go check them out at river.com/TBL for a special offer of up to $100 in Bitcoin for free when you purchase.